encourage that type of trade. And furthermore, they took the Chinese dynastic name Wei, W-E-I. It's an old dynastic name, and they're often known as the Northern Wei, to distinguish themselves from that earlier Chinese kingdom. And they set the pattern for future nomadic conquerors of China, including the Mongols, above all the Mongols, that when you enter into China, when you take parts of China proper, you cannot rule them by horseback. You have to co-opt the Chinese administrative class, who come to be known as the Mandarins, who follow the Confucian classics. You have to have administrators. It is also better to tax the peasantry rather than to simply plunder it and turn Chinese cities into pastures. And so the Northern Wei play an important role there. Above all, they're great sponsors of Buddhism. And it's because of these early emperors, especially the second one, Tai Wu, that Buddhism enters China and really begins to spread across the Chinese population, not only in northern China, but also in southern China. Tai Wu commissions a remarkable set of colossal statues at the city of Yungang, which is today really an international tourist treasure. They are five colossal statues which show earlier incarnations of the Buddha. And this is the emperor himself, Tai Wu, and his ancestors essentially projecting themselves as earlier avatars or incarnations of the Buddha, if you will. So the Northern Wei set the agenda and set the model for future nomadic conquerors and the relationship of nomads when they come into the Chinese world. Genghis Khan, and above all his grandson Kublai Khan, learned very important lessons if they had followed the Wei script. And significantly, they would too take a Chinese name, sponsor Buddhism, and follow a number of the same policies. Well, in 581, a fellow by the name of Emperor Wen began a series of campaigns to reunite China. By 589, he had battled his way to control of the entire Middle Kingdom. The Northern Wei were brought under his control, all of the southern kingdoms were united, and once again, China was a single unitary imperial state. The second emperor, Yang, of this Sui dynasty, blundered into waging a war against the Koreans. He got involved in wars with the steppe nomads. He left no powerful successor, and when he died in either late 617 or perhaps early 618, he was succeeded by a Li, a duke, who was related to the imperial family through his mom's side, and he established a new dynasty, which we call the Tang dynasty. And the Tang dynasty is essentially a continuation of the Sui. Gao Zhu is the throne name that this warlord took. Throne names are the names that Chinese emperors are known historically. He was from a powerful military family called the Li family, and he and his son, Taizong, both of them proved to be extraordinary emperors. The Tang dynasty is looked upon as the apex of early Chinese civilization. And in one sense, it is the empire in which China achieves its greatest territorial extent, far greater than the earlier Han Empire. However, it is significant that this Tang Empire was not purely a Chinese empire. It owed a great deal to the frontier society I discussed in earlier lectures along the northern Chinese border, of which the Northern Wei were just one manifestation, in which Chinese and nomadic peoples had been interacting at least since the 3rd century BC. Gao Zhu and Taizong, the first two Tang emperors, were not typical Confucians. They were known to be great equestrians. They reveled in battle. Now, of course, the first emperor was a Li or duke. That was his job on the frontier. But the early Tang emperors, quite uncharacteristically of later Tang rulers and especially of Chinese emperors from the Song dynasty down on to really till the overthrow of the monarchy and the end of the Republican Revolution, they were not commanders. They did not go out and wage war personally. That was done by generals. They were the son of heaven. They had more important duties to do back in the Chinese homeland. And yet the Tang emperors, quite the contrary, were emperors who were expert in fighting. They are known to have command armies. They were personally involved in military reforms. They also had a hand in picking excellent generals. The most important general is a man named Li Jing. I've mentioned him earlier. And he is behind the reform of the early Tang Empire, the early Tang army under the first two emperors. Chinese armies had been always impressive. They were essentially based on corvée labor. That is, all the adult males of the Chinese Empire owed their labor services to the emperor, either on great building projects such as the Grand Canal or other such public projects, or 1 year's military service and possibly a second year of garrison service. And this had characterized Chinese armies since the Han period. The army is reorganized in the early Tang period quite significantly into seven divisions. These were very, very powerful field armies with 20,000 men, at least 4,000 cavalry assigned to each division. That is 20% of the force. This is cavalry armed in the up-to-date weapons that the Turks had pioneered, that is metal stirrups, the Lamalar armor. It included horse archers. Above all, the Chinese divisions were well-equipped with archers, crossbowmen, and field artillery. The logistics of the Chinese army, which is only imperfectly understood, was clearly superb. Tang armies numbering between 50,000 and 150,000 are reported as mobilized against distant objectives in Korea, against the steppe nomads, and down in the south, along the borders of what today would be called Vietnam, into what is now Yunnan province, which was then a wild and woolly frontier zone. Li Jing and his colleagues were behind this military reorganization, and they also perfected the strategy and tactics to bring the nomads to battle. In 628, after some humiliating defeats at the hands of the Gurk Turks, the emperor, Taizong, decided to reckon with the Turkish Khan. The Khan at the time was a fellow by the name of Ilje. A huge army was mobilized. Two great columns, one commanded by Li Jing, penetrated into the Turkish homeland, and on May 2nd, 630, brought the Gurk-Turk army to bay, forced it into a battle, using very much the tactics I discussed earlier that the Romans had devised against nomads. It's almost a textbook copy of it. I mean, similar problems generally generate similar solutions. And Li Jing was clearly one of the great generals in all of Chinese history. The victory is decisive. The Khan himself is captured. The Turkish army goes down in defeat. And as I mentioned, many Turks were recruited into the imperial army. And one aspect about the Tang and later armies of Chinese emperors, these armies were above nationality. Once you were recruited into the army, into those divisions, you were essentially going to be assimilated as a Chinese soldier. The victory over the Khan meant the Eastern Gurk Khanate collapsed. The Turkish tribes acknowledged the authority of the Tang emperor, Taizong. In 641, Tang armies reappeared in Korea. Shortly afterwards, by the late 640s, the Tang armies had swept through the Tarim Basin and had brought that entire area back under Tang control. And in 657, a Tang army won an even more significant victory over the Western Gurk Turks and forced the Western Turks to acknowledge the authority of the Emperor of China. And so by 660, all of the central and eastern nomadic zones, all of those regions, essentially were ruled by the Emperor of China, almost in the capacity of a Khan, while to his Chinese subjects, he ruled as a son of heaven. It was without a doubt the greatest imperial order on the globe at this point. However, it rested very much on these Chinese emperors adopting an aggressive military policy, being directly involved, hands-on involved, with the campaigns along the frontiers. And it is easy to forget this fact if one studies Chinese history simply from its internal developments, from the great classics, from the writings of the Confucian historians. And in the later tradition, There's great admiration, particularly for Gai Tzu and Tai Tsong, the first two Tang emperors. Those are throne names that are taken by many lesser men in later dynasties. Nonetheless, you get the sense there's always this ambiguous feeling. They really weren't fully Confucian emperors. They spent too much time palling around with their generals, of going out and riding and carrying out hunting expeditions. And these are activities that later Chinese emperors tended to avoid, stressing far more knowledge of the classics, calligraphy, and creating a huge court to distance themselves between their subjects and their servants and the Son of Heaven. So the Tang Empire, to some extent, is not only Chinese, but it is also a product of the interaction of Chinese civilization with the nomadic peoples going back to the Xuan Nu. It was extremely successful. Its success has been tested in several ways, and that is a result of finds archaeology. This would be the regions that the Chinese had historically called the Western regions. Now, these regions had been under Han control, particularly after the great Han victories, essentially between 75 and 91 AD, really extending into 102 AD, notably Ban Chao, the later Han general who brought those areas under control. We have some documents from the Han period. They have survived from garrison cities in the Tarim Basin, but we have a wealth of documents surviving from the Tang period. And these are on bamboo, leather, and wooden tablets, parchment, scrolls, whatever, you know, documents. They're documents. And what they give us is a wealth of information of how the Tang emperors organized what they called the four garrisons. That is, the Tarim Basin was divided into four garrisons, four separate military governors with an overall superintendent of the entire region. They were based on the great caravan cities, Khotan, Kucha, Kashgar, and Yangji, to pronounce it in its Chinese form. These four garrisons had Chinese military colonists. They also included native populations and many nomadic peoples, probably Turkish speakers from the base, on the basis of the names, who are now serving the Emperor of China. And the documents of the military garrison show that the Chinese had a major impact in stimulating and the development of cities in the Tarim Basin. For one, large amounts of stock raising and horses particularly were needed, and the Tang developed those activities in the Tarim Basin. The soldiers had to be paid. Thousands of examples of what are known as Chinese cash coins. These are cast coins going back to the Han period. The basic day-to-day currency is a cast bronze coin. The word cash is actually a loanword from the Portuguese through the Malay dialects from a later period. And nonetheless, they're paid in coins, and the soldiers start spending this money in the caravan cities and monetized markets. It's clear in the 8th and 9th centuries that coins were in common use throughout the cities of the Tarim Basin, even when Tang rule over this region lapsed in the late 8th and early 9th centuries. In addition, it brought many Chinese settlers, Chinese pilgrims. The Mogao Caves near Dongguan indicate a significant influx of Chinese. Chinese now becomes a language well known in the Tarim Basin. And it is really the basis for the development of the Chinese population now living there in what the Uyghurs would prefer to call Eastern Turkestan. I have called neutrally the Tarim Basin. It goes back to this Tang settlement. And it results in a very, very subtle interaction between the Tang court, the caravan cities, and the various tribes of the Central and Eastern Eurasian steppes. This is an impressive political order. However, it was expensive to maintain. And we do have some accounts of the rising costs. And the rising costs are staggering. Already at the end of the 7th century AD, the imperial budget is increasingly facing military and frontier costs. And these came from several several items on the budget. First was the fielding of great armies and garrisons, notably in the western region, in the western districts, the so-called four garrisons. It also resulted from expeditions, and these were expeditions that were waged not only in on the steppes, but in Korea and into the south. Furthermore, the Tang emperors carried out certain important activities that were very costly. One was the repair and the manning of the Great Walls. These had fallen in disarray after the fall or the fragmenting of the Han Dynasty, and it was repaired and extended under the Tang. It was expensive. It was particularly expensive to maintain and repair, to garrison. Generally, many men called up for military service under the conscript system would then be sent off to do garrison duty. So you could at least take 2 or 3 years out of your life serving the emperor with the obligatory military service. The Tang emperors and their predecessors, Emperor Wen and Yang of the Sui dynasty, also began to link the various canal systems that go back really to the Han and before into what eventually becomes known as the Grand Canal, which stretches some 1,400 miles and connects the Yellow River region with the Yangtze or the Yangtze. And that canal system was necessary for military movement, for moving forces and supplies between northern and southern China, but above all, for supply of foodstuffs and silk. That is, southern China increasingly was producing the rice and silk that sustained the monarchy. Silk was the commodity on the Silk Road. It was the prime currency for all major transactions. That is, pieces of silk, bolts would be the word, bolts of silk, were counted out in order to make major payments to contractors, to foreign princes, to nomadic warlords, whatever. And then the bronze coins and rice were used in everyday transactions. So the canal was necessary for the moving of the silk out of the Yangtze Valley into the cities of Zhanang and Luang, the classic cities of northern China, the ancient capitals, and then through the Jade Gate and west. In addition, the Yellow River Valley system, which had been the homeland of Chinese civilization, certainly the core of Chinese civilization grew there, that homeland apparently was becoming drier and less fertile over the early centuries of the first century AD. By the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century, we hear of problems of flooding. The crops and conditions are not so good. That could account in part for the migration of Chinese into the southern lands. And part of the reason for building that canal was to feed the great capitals in the north, the historic centers. And so henceforth, the Grand Canal is strategic not only for the control of China, but for feeding the northern capitals, for shipping the silk out to points west. And that was an immense expense on the Tang budget. Now, the figures have been calculated. They rise considerably. An annual budget of some 2,000 cash on military expenditures starts to jump to figures of 15, 20,000, many times the original expenditures by the end of the 7th century. And this is a fiscal pressure that all Tang emperors are under. The second important pressure on the monarchy is maintaining the northern frontiers. We have, fortunately, some figures from the early Tang period. And these come from the years 712 to 755. That is, on the eve of the An Lushan Rebellion, which is in part a rebellion against the fiscal demands. In 712, military expenditures were reckoned at 2 million strings of cash. That would be 100 bronze coins strung together. By 742, it has risen to 6 times to 12 million. By 755, on the eve of the rebellion, it is now 15 million strings of cash. Now, under these pressures, pressures to pay the army, the heavy building costs, to maintain the capitals, the Grand Canal, all of this lost the emperor a great deal of sympathy. And it contributed to a major rebellion from 755 to 763 that was headed up by a disaffected general on Lushan, and one could argue that the dynasty was really done in by internal matters. But that's only part of the story. Before the outbreak of that rebellion, 4 years earlier, in 751, the Tang dynasty suffered several significant defeats. Actually, in 751, they suffered three significant defeats on the frontiers, and these were by armies commanded by their generals. The first was in Korea. Well, there's always a problem invading Korea, and any emperor with any sense would avoid Korea. The second one was in the distant regions today, that would be Yunnan, which was another border area. But the third one, the one that really hit home, was the defeat in 751 on the Talas River. And we'll be talking about this battle when we're dealing with the interaction between Islamic civilization and the Turks. In that battle, a Chinese army, and it was a very, very important blow, army of the Abbasid Caliphs, that is the Caliph of the Islamic world. Both sides fielded nomadic cavalry. And the Chinese army was state-of-the-art, crossbows, heavy infantry, supported by nomadic cavalry. But what happened in that battle is the nomadic allies, the Turks, deserted over to the Muslim side. The Chinese army was badly defeated, even though it fought a gallant fighting withdrawal from the battlefield. And the result was a decisive win for the Muslims. And that victory for the Muslims would make Islam the religion of victory in the eyes of the nomadic peoples. And it was a very, very important blow to the credibility of the Tang emperors. And those defeats, which fed into the fiscal demands and weaknesses, which fed into the perceptions that the Tang emperors had lost the mandate of heaven, resulted in the explosion of the An Lushan Rebellion, led by a Uyghur Turkish general who had fallen out of favor and really was driven to rebellion because of scandals about him in the court. In the end, the Tang emperors triumphed. They put the rebellion down. But it turned out to be a demographic and fiscal disaster. The Chinese armies were withdrawn from the Western garrisons. The Tibetans controlled the Tarim Basin and Silk Road for the next 75 years. And while Tang armies reappeared in the 840s and 850s and reimposed some authority over the Tarim Basin, it was never the same. And above all, the Tang emperors had made deals with the warlords to regain their throne. And by 907, the Tang dynasty, the Tang Empire, again fragmented, just like its predecessor, the Han Empire. And as a result, China once again became homes to competing warlords and new nomads settling in the Middle Kingdom. But above all, the defeat on the battlefield of Talas marked a new turning point in the history of the steppes and of China, because for the first time, the power of Islam had projected itself over the steppes, and that will be the subject of the following lectures.
Lecture 16. Avars, Bulgars, and Constantinople.
In this lecture, I want to shift our focus away from the Eastern Eurasian steppes and the Chinese world, back across those steppes to the Western arm. That would be the region stretching from essentially the lower and middle Danube rivers to the Ural River that empties into the Caspian Sea. And we want to focus on the interaction of the Turkish peoples with the greatest Christian civilization of the early Middle Ages, which happens to be Constantinople or New Rome. We frequently call it the Byzantine Empire. Usually that designates the Eastern Roman Empire that survived the imperial collapse of the 5th century, was shorn of its eastern and southern possessions by the Arabic expansion of the 7th century AD, and came to rest on the peninsula of Asia Minor, the Balkans, and southern Italy. And very often when we think of the Middle Ages, we think of Western Europe. But at the time of the Tang, the Sui and the Tang dynasties, the great nomadic confederations of the Avars, the Gurk Turks, and the Uyghurs, it was Constantinople, not Western Europe, that represented the great urban civilization on the western end of the Eurasian steppes. And in the next three lectures, this one and the succeeding two, we'll look at the relationship between Byzantine civilization, the Byzantine emperors, and the peoples of the steppes. As a way of understanding what the Byzantine perception was of these northern peoples, we should recall that the emperors who ruled in Constantinople saw themselves as Roman emperors, saw themselves as heirs to the empire going back to Augustus, and they were particularly conscious of the crisis that late Roman emperors had encountered from the Huns in the 5th century AD. And the emperors had drawn several important lessons due to the dealings with Attila the Hun. One was to pursue a policy of divide and conquer, that is to undermine any kind of incipient confederacy on the steppes. And that would be any collection of inner and outer tribes that would be united under a Khan stretching from the Danube essentially to the Volga River, and make sure that the tribes fought among themselves. It has often been remarked that Byzantine diplomacy is perhaps the most contorted and clever of all diplomacies that anyone has ever created. And it was largely devised for dealing with steppe nomads, not so much the people of the Balkans or the great Islamic powers. And there's an anecdote that captures the attitude of the steppe peoples themselves to the Byzantines, particularly Byzantine diplomats who were known as basilikoi, that is, representatives of the emperor. The emperor is Basileus in Byzantine Greek. And one of them, a man named Valentinus, probably in 575 AD, was sent to negotiate with Tardush, who was the leader of the Western Gurk Turks. His official title at the time was probably not Khan, but Yabgu, a subordinate title. And as the envoy approached, and Tardush had been in contact with the Byzantines before, he saw the Byzantine envoy in his presence, and he immediately said, "Oh my gosh, it's a typical Roman who speaks 10 languages and the one lie." And that is, the Byzantines are constantly trying to use diplomacy to maneuver these people around with the same type of artful, fast-talking diplomats and gifts that the Han and Tang emperors used. The other important lesson that they drew was to trust to the walls of Constantinople. I discussed those walls in conjunction with Attila and the fact that the Great Walls acted as a barrier to nomadic peoples who would enter into the Eastern Empire by crossing the Danube and invading the European provinces, and that the walls were such a barrier that no nomadic conqueror, no matter how sophisticated his engines of war were, could possibly breach those walls. And that's proved historically, time and time again. Avars, Bulgars, Cumans, Pecheneks, even the Rus, that is, Vikings on ships who appear before Constantinople, fail to take the great city. And that is because the masonry Roman architecture could defy any invader really until the advent of artillery, which is quite in contrast to what Han and Tang emperors encountered. That is, as impressive as the fortifications of the Great Wall might seem to us today, those are Ming fortifications of the 14th century. In the Tang period, at the time that is contemporary with the early Byzantine state of